Welcome to the latest episode of Streamed and Screened, a podcast from Lee Enterprises that is all about movies and TV shows that you should check out. We've got Bruce Miller on the call. Bruce Miller, a longtime entertainment journalist, currently the editor at the Sioux City Journal. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Chris. How are you today?
That voice, that is a...
Doesn't it sound good? That sounds pretty good, didn't it?
That's smooth as sugar right there.
At a time when the world was falling apart, we turned to the movies.
Also at Sioux City, we have reporter Jared McNett. Hello, Jared.
Howdy, howdy, hi, hi.
We almost didn't have Jared this week because he went into that murder house.
In Villisca, Iowa.
And You know what? We can see them not coming out. It's just like all those things that Vera Farmiga stars in.
The people that run that place now, they did put a creepy doll in the attic of the house. And the guy that does tours said he was trying to make his own Annabelle doll, basically.
If anybody wants to find out more about Jared's trip to haunted houses, you can definitely check him out on Twitter.
Yep.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes, as well as I'm sure we'll repost something on the Streamed and Streamed podcast Twitter account.
He took a picture of him and he looks creepy in the picture. Like he's maybe been stabbed or something.
Wait, Jared does?
Yeah, he does. Don't you think, Jared? You're sitting on the floor and it's like, oh my God, somebody killed him. I think he's dead.
Sitting on the floor in the attic in front of the doll, actually.
And there is no way that I would have gone there to rescue him. So he should know now that if he had that hope that I would rush out there and save him from those creepy dolls and everything else in that scary house, no. The answer is no.
And me, the sort of ringleader, I guess, of this motley crew, Chris Lay. I wish I was calling in from my mansion in Majorca, but instead I'm just in Madison, Wisconsin, doing my duties as the podcast operations manager for Lee Enterprises. And we have a very fun show today. We're going to talk about The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, and we're going to talk about The Northman. Both of those are in theaters. And The Survivor, the new Ben Foster movie on Apple Plus. And we'll have an interview between Bruce and the folks behind Survivor, which is on HBO Max. You'll hear more about that very soon. Yeah, so we can totally jump right in, feet first, not unlike a couple guys off of a cliff in Spain, into The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Let's give it to Jared because he likes Nicolas Cage.
I went through a full range of stuff in the lead up to this movie because when I first heard about it, I got really excited at the prospect of Nicolas Cage being in something like this. It's kind of a very meta journey through his career, I guess. And then a little bit closer to before this came out, so in the past couple of weeks, I was starting to get a little nervous that, you know, it was maybe going to lean a little too much on the Nick Cage is like a meme kind of thing. So I did have a little bit of that. And we even talked about that last week on the show. So I did have a little bit of that apprehensiveness going into seeing it. But once I actually saw it, I was totally delighted by it. It was just a really strong buddy comedy that really felt like a throwback to the kinds of comedies that don't really get released in theaters anymore and just end up on, you know, streaming platforms and stuff like that. Nicolas Cage was great in it. I'm always happy when he gets to do, you know, put his comedic chops to good use, and he definitely gets plenty of opportunities to do that in this. And I think the real MVP in the movie, though, was Pedro Pascal, who was just such a joy to watch throughout that entire movie. It's just this massive super fan of Nicolas Cage, and that's where some of my favorite stuff in the movie was.
You know, when I first saw Pedro, I thought, who does he look like? He looks like somebody. And I realized it was Burt Reynolds. He could do the Burt Reynolds story in a heartbeat because he looks like Burt. And you think you could do Smokey and the Bandit immediately. Let's have you do that. But you're right. It's the relationship between the two that make this work. The thing that I find was interesting is that they didn't want to offend Nicolas Cage. So they didn't really bring up some of those dreadful films he did for money. I mean, they referenced the concept, but they don't say, and then, whoa, this is, you were really bad in that, because Pedro plays a fanboy. He is just enamored with everything that he does. So it's not going to be bad stuff that they mention. And I think Nicolas Cage could have taken it. I think if he, you know, if they had said, oh God, you really sucked in this one, he would have been fine with it. But there is that kind of level of, we're honoring you instead of kind of lampooning you. Does that make sense?
I think it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. I would have liked the ending to be different, and I don't want to go into what it is, but I thought the ending was too predictable, and I think they could have pivoted in a way that it wouldn't have been. And I think that would have been kind of fun. But I enjoyed myself all during the course of it. It was fun seeing them race around. And I love that they said, well, you're supposed to be really good at driving stunt cars. Didn't you drive stunt cars at one time?
Gone in 60 seconds.
I don't know that I would ride with him at all. And then they were taking drugs and they're driving, and you think those cliffs are going to fall off in any minute. It's, yeah.
I mean, I would totally, you know, ride with him if it was in the car in the film, where he definitely beats the hell out of it. And then by the time they roll back,
you don't see any dance.
A lot. There's like no damage to this, you know,
classic. No dance to the car. Yeah. But, and I, you know, I don't like the idea where they bring a kid in. There's always some kid that you have to worry about. I don't want to worry about a kid, you know, that they might be kidnapped or they might be suddenly used as something against you. That's a real hoary plot device that movies like to reach for. And I didn't think it needed it.
Yeah. I think, I mean, you mentioned the movies that he's done that are not exactly critically beloved, let's say, the VOD, you know, straight to disc sorts of things that he was doing for a while, which, and even those, the vast majority of them, he still fully committed to.
And even within those, Chris, because I've watched quite a few of them now, because I still go to Redbox pretty frequently, and Redbox has a,
they live in Redbox.
They do. And so I've watched quite a few of those even. And even within those, as you were kind of saying, there's like gradations of them. There are some that are actually like a lot of fun to watch, and there are some that are like an absolute slog, and that depends less on like Nicolas Cage and just like everything else around him usually in those movies. So
of the three of us, I think I liked it the least. And it's not that it's a bad movie. I totally agree with Bruce, where I feel like it, the finale, you know, sequence was a little too on the nose maybe. And maybe it's just, I mean, for me, I feel like there are a lot of gradations, you know, there's a lot of different colors and shades that Nicolas Cage has been able to wring out of his career. And this just didn't really pay the right kind of service to, I think, the Nicolas Cage stuff that I really like. I mean, it didn't, in the big room that Pedro Pascal's character has, with all of the trophies and the items and the knickknacks and whatever, you know, you see, you know, the thing of Pampers from Raising Arizona, but that's like all that's really mentioned from that film. There's nothing, you know, mentioned about adaptation. You know, Leaving Las Vegas is, you know, pretty much out of the mix as well. And it seems like the movie was very much about the popcorn movies that Nicolas Cage was in, the, you know, the John Woo movies, the Con Airs, the, which are all great, but that is a very specific kind of Nicolas Cage. It just seemed like I guess no one's going to go in there expecting to get a nuanced portrayal of Nicolas Cage as an actor in this film, but it just didn't quite hit on all those notes. But I mean, the other side of that argument is, well, he's got like 100 different kinds of roles that he plays. He's, you know, you can't do all of that. So I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it. I think the thing that's going to really test it for me is I'm actually going back to see it tomorrow, because a couple friends of mine are in from out of town. And so we'll actually get to do like the hangout version of this movie. And that seems like a, you know, if it can make it through that, then it'll totally be worth it. But yeah.
There should have been more fanboying that would help you through that if you didn't see some of those films. Pedro could have said, now say this line. I want to hear this line. Say this line for me from whatever. And then you could get that line and that kind of recalls things for you. I think they were hedging their bets in case they couldn't get Nicolas Cage and they would be able to just kind of slip in somebody else and make a reference. And I tried to think, who would that be? Who would be somebody that would fall into this? I thought of Johnny Depp. I thought Johnny Depp could be one that he would bring a little attitude. So you'd think there was a different Johnny Depp. And we've seen that where they've been kind of playing versions of themselves. And I also thought Charlie Sheen would have been one because Charlie Sheen had this really celebrated past where he was in all these really good movies. And then he started doing kind of whatever I can find for money. TV kind of things. That one where he was shooting the series, I think they did like 3 episodes a week or whatever it was. Come on. Charlie Sheen would be perfect for something like this. And you could really make fun of him if you wanted to. But I think they were respectful. And I think that's where maybe they could have been a little more liberal with their things. He would have been fine with it. I'm sure he would have been fine with it. But you know, it's like, oh, and you're the greatest star ever. I just love you. You had all those great films and I just love all those films. And you know, hey, what about that turkey? Why did you take that turkey? I want to know. Tell me, because if you have this guy hostage in your house, you're not going to just hang out with him. You're going to ask every question you possibly can if you're that much of a fan.
The only real approach that the movie takes to that is the weird, not obsession, but the role that guarding Tess plays in the film.
That was surprising to me.
Yeah. But yeah, there's no mention of any of the straight to video stuff or even going back, you know, the Trapped in Paradise, the, you know, weird, not quite blockbuster, obviously, but you know, late 80s, early 90s kind of oddball things that he did. I think, yeah, my problem is it just feels like with the concept, you know, the conceptual angle of the movie, it just feels like they left money on the table. But, you know, you're not every movie like this is going to be Being John Malkovich, which, by the way, Charlie Sheen, great little cameo in that one. So that's my 2 cents. I don't know, Jared, if you want to ungrumpify my take with a button on this.
I'm good with leaving it there.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it. It was just not quite.
Come on, you guys didn't get to see it at Northman. Let's hear what you thought.
Well, Chris, did you also watch The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent and The Northman as a double feature? Because I did indeed. That on Friday.
Yep. And I went Unbearable Weight into Northman.
That's what I did as well.
It wasn't really jarring. It was, but those are definitely horses of different colors, shall we say.
I don't even know if those are both horses.
One's just covered in a lot more mud. That's the,
and maybe disemboweled also.
Yes. Yeah. Before we get too far into this, dear listener, if you have any interest in The Northman, go back to last week. Bruce interviewed the director, Robert Eggers, and it's absolutely fantastic. And having seen the movie now, it holds up even more as a really great interview. So please go back. We'll have links to that in the show notes. But yeah, Jared, what do you think, man?
I already like wrote about this a little bit in my review that I posted on my letterbox, but I remember seeing like one or two people saying that they thought the movie, or they felt that the movie left them kind of cold. And after I saw the movie, I really don't understand that at all, because even though it's like in, you know, Scandinavia and it's a revenge movie, it is a very alive and very like big fiery kind of movie, like with like very fiery emotion in it. Not just the revenge stuff, but like the romance stuff that develops was actually pretty compelling too, I thought. And so I was just a little confused by that. As for the movie itself, I absolutely loved it. I am always down to go and see a movie that shows me stuff that I haven't seen before. And by God, there's more than a few things in that movie that I have not seen in any other movies, including Ethan Hawke, Willem Dafoe, and I don't even know who the kid was. I'm blanking on his name. I didn't think I would expect to see a scene in the movie where they're crawling around on all fours and like howling like wolves and farting and whatever else. But that happens in the movie. We get multiple shots of like a family tree with like Ethan Hawke's dead body dangling off of it. Didn't think we'd be seeing that, but we did.
Bjork, you got Bjork.
Yes, got that in there. There was so much in there that it showed me that I was impressed by, and again, stuff I wouldn't have seen elsewhere. And then like the plot itself and everything, I was all the way in on, and I was actually kind of surprised how long they were able to stretch out the revenge stuff in the movie. Because Alexander Skarsgård kind of gets to where he needs to be sooner than I thought he would. And then he really just like slowly unleashes hell. It's a slow burn in some respects once that revenge actually starts unfolding.
There's, you know, a moment where you're like, is this where the movie ends? Like, we've still got a little bit of time here. What's going on? And then, the movie, it finds a whole new gear that I did not see coming. Which is, you know, kind of alluded to and referenced vaguely in the interview that Bruce did, and then also some of the other interviews that I've heard with Eggers. And then it becomes this really unique film. I was floored by it. I really enjoyed it.
Let me ask you a question, because I did not see this until news started coming out about it. CGI genitals. Did I miss this at some point?
During the fight. Which you mentioned in the interview, the fight in the volcano.
Could you tell it was CGI?
I couldn't tell that it was CGI, but a little ways into that fight, I definitely realized, oh, these guys are butt naked. And yeah, well, if they were really butt naked, there would be more, flaccidity. Is that an appropriate word?
Like, I'm more concerned about the knives that were out, right?
Yeah.
You know, is this a new thing? Do we need CGI genitals? Is this it? Is this what the next phase is? Everybody wants them to be drawn in or something?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, it's a...
But I didn't realize it was a thing until when they started saying, and then there was... Who knew? I just kind of accepted that the guys, because it's so dark, they just took their clothes off and went at it with swords.
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't I didn't see anything, you know, flip-flopping around or anything out there. So it seemed like if anything, the genitals were more removed given, you know, the circumstances. So.
But I that's odd that would come out as a thing, you know?
I mean, it's something that I made a mental note of in the moment. Didn't take me out of the scene or anything. Didn't you know, strike me as any intense, aesthetic decision one way or the other, but I certainly acknowledged it.
So that'll be the future. Is it, were your genitals CGI or were they the real thing? This is what we'll be hearing about movies now from now on.
I don't know about the future, but this isn't like... some Tomorrowland, you know, kind of.
I would definitely request it. You know, if I were in a movie like this, say we're going to do a nude scene, okay? And and I demand that I have CGI. Please, please.
I will say I didn't expect that in the movie we would get a detour into a very old-timey sport. And I also did not expect for that detour into an old-timey sport to include someone basically headbutting someone else to death. So that was a nice little stopover for a few minutes.
Well, now you know where that started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bloodiest game of hockey or whatever the hell that was supposed to be possible.
Hey, yeah.
Shirts and skins.
Yep. Yeah, there was, I don't know, the gore elements of it, I think, were a little overblown. It's not that it was incredibly gory or unrealistically gory or anything, but it seems like people are talking very much about how gory it is, and there's only a couple of moments where I'm like, that's over the top, but in a way that was fitting. So it's
much like how I kind of think about like the Coen brothers will handle violence in their movies, where like there's not necessarily violence all the way through, but when there is, it is pretty heavy and pretty intense, I think is the way to think about it. One other thing I was going to point out is, Bruce talked about how good Claes Bang was in it as the traitorous uncle, and he absolutely was. I really loved the eventual gear that Nicole Kidman got into with like where her character kind of ends up toward the tail end of the movie. Good gear for her that she doesn't get to go into in a lot of her stuff now. So I was happy to see that as well.
It's a great surprise. And she needs more of those surprises. You know, she works a lot, but I don't know that she's always working in the way that she would like to kind of grow. They see that she can play these cold, kind of cool women who maybe are, you know, being abused by her husband, Alexander Skarsgård, in the HBO miniseries.
Big Little Lies.
Yes. And, but she can really bring it if you really want her. And I would love to see her kind of open up and be that, that kind of mean woman that you're looking for.
Yeah. Go back to the, you know, to Die For version of Nicole Kidman. Let's get some really weird Nicole Kidman roles.
You know what? I think if had she had that film and not married Tom Cruise and gone off on that whole kind of tangent with him on those films, she would be a different actress today because she was incredible in that film. Incredible. Let's hear, you both were excited about it. You would say,
oh yeah.
Good. Well, I, when I was watching it, I thought about both of you and I thought this is one they'll like. I think this is this will be working for them.
No, I thought it was fantastic. I don't know what workout regimen Skarsgård was on to make that whole thing happen.
Oh, it was incredible. It was incredible. He said he barely ate, and what he was eating, you wouldn't eat. And like, no, I wouldn't do it. But hey, it was a lot of those scenes were in the dark. There was a lot of good lighting. The makeup could add to the whole thing. So we might look just as good.
And I was reading an article earlier today. And I mean, they only shot this movie for like 87 days, like less than 3 months. They filmed it. It was all filmed on, you know, 35 millimeter film, like no digital film. Like, I mean, for the intense shots that they're getting, the, you know, really choreographed one shots that they get. And I technically, it's insane. I can't imagine the, you know, getting the dolly shots, you know, through that big battle sequence early on, you know, and how many times they had to do it and reset and reset and reset. But I guess, you know, maybe thankfully it's just overcast all the time. So
walking up those hills, you walk up those hills and you think, I'm going to fall back at some point. You know, somebody's got to die on his sword. It might be me. But yeah, it's incredible what they were able to accomplish. And it's not CGI.
Screening of The Northman that I went to was actually pretty well full. And one of the guys that was coming out was a very bro-y, stoner kind of guy, had a stocking cap on. And his review to his friend as they were leaving the theater was for him to just say, that movie was badass. So...
I think I texted my pals and I said, yeah, The Northman whips ass. That's what I said.
There you go.
Yeah, it does indeed. Anya Taylor-Joy is going places.
You know, she seems like one of those actresses that is very specific and you think she can only do certain things. They won't cast her in things. And man, she's had a great little career going here where you go, yeah, I buy that. I buy that character. And I loved her was it Last Night in Soho?
Mm-hmm.
Loved her in that. But the, you know, so she's surprising us all the time. And I like the idea that that'll happen more. She'll get good work.
Yep. I think, Queen's Gambit obviously is what really put her over the top. But even before that, obviously The Witch put her on the map. And then even something that was relatively unseen like Thoroughbreds is another just tremendous.
Great movie.
Yeah. Underseen. That's one that I like. That year, I think like that, and was like A Simple Favor. There were just these kind of very pulpy, you know, movies that came out around that same time that I would love to see get rediscovered. So any which way, but. So yeah, I don't know what else we could possibly say about The Northman other than go and see it. What is coming out in theaters this weekend? Not a whole lot. That's like on that level. The biggest one that is most broadly appealing is probably Memory, the new Liam Neeson movie about an assassin for hire, kind of stumbles down his own conspiracy, but also he's going through some kind of mental illness or dementia or memory loss type thing. So having a trained killer losing their grip on reality is...
is he saving a kid at some point?
Probably.
Yeah. They could, if they ever had a problem where they didn't get the scene shot, they could borrow him from another movie, because he's kind of doing the same thing in most of this stuff. And you could do a whole film where he just looks mean, hiding behind a rock or hiding behind a door or hiding behind a corner. That's Liam Neeson.
Well, we were talking about the direct-to-video stuff that Nick Cage has done. It seems like, he alternates. He does the one for them, one for me type thing, where, he'll do the weird color out of space. He'll do Mandy. He'll do, in between these weird, not great Redbox type titles. But Liam Neeson just doesn't really do that. Like, he's just doing the same, gruff guy with a gun in slightly different roles every single time. And
he already, Chris, he already did one of these movies earlier this year, and I bet you can't remember the name of it right now.
No.
No. Blacklight.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yep.
I remember.
See, that's how many of these he does.
Yeah.
He does. It's like a TV series. He's doing episodes every week, and it's the same thing. But, he's good. He's a good actor.
Oh, absolutely.
He just takes the route of the easy paycheck.
Yeah. And this is, I'm not at all knocking him as an actor. It's just kind of frustrating because he seems very wasted in these things. And I'm sure that there's more to it than that. I know, going back however many, 10, 15 years when it was like his wife died. I mean, he's had some pretty traumatic life experiences that it seems like around the time that he started taking these roles. And I don't know how much of that has played into that. I don't want to overthink any of that, but it seems like he's definitely let that put a hand on the wheel of his career. But I mean, yeah, checks are clearing, so he's doing fine. And he's still got the Star Wars money coming in.
We could do an Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent with him, as the character.
Chris, you're talking about how he really doesn't do the one for them, one for me kind of thing. And what makes it even more frustrating is like two of the ones that he has done when he rarely does them anymore that were more of a one for me kind of thing, Silence and then Widows. He's fantastic in both of those in kind of a more limited role, but he's great in those. So he absolutely can still do that kind of stuff if he wants to.
Those are two perfect examples of that. But it really is instead of like one for me, one for them, it's one for me and then, a baker's dozen for them.
For the bank.
Yeah.
We're banking this one. He did do one film though with his son, and that was kind of interesting. Rom-com that was a little more, it took a little different tone for him. But
Memory, maybe it'll be a little bit more interesting than those other ones. It's directed by Martin Campbell, who did Casino Royale, GoldenEye, Mask of Zorro.
And The Foreigner, which is actually a really good action movie, I think.
Yep. The Foreigner and last year's The Protégé, which I don't think that we were too kind on, but it's very much that, Martin Campbell knows how to make a mid-level action movie.
Yep.
Green Lantern notwithstanding. And that's like the biggest one. And then there's the other two movies that I think are worth talking about. I don't think these will be screening everywhere. But Vortex, the new Gaspar Noé movie. Gaspar Noé, everyone, maybe not everyone, but Irreversible is one of the most notorious films ever made from two decades ago, starring Monica Bellucci, who's also got a role in Memory. I'm not trying to... Wow, there really are some interesting like parallels, because Vortex is about an elderly couple who is going through dementia. So I'm assuming that he's going to be applying a lot of his aesthetic abilities to conveying what that experience is like. And Dario Argento is one of the actors, interestingly enough.
I'll be interested to check that one out, because I still haven't actually gotten around to catching his movie from, I guess it was just, I don't know, it was 3 years ago now. No, I saw Climax. Climax was very good. I enjoyed Climax quite a bit. If anyone wants a just completely wild, like party-fueled kind of movie that turns horribly wrong, Climax is great for that. So I will definitely be interested to check this one out whenever I get the chance to.
Yeah, his stuff is always very maximalist. I think that is it's a decent adjective for that. And this seems like it is going really hard in the other direction of very, very minimalist. So I'm intrigued to see where he goes with that. His movies have been interesting to me, but none of them that I would be, I've been really floored by, I guess. But anyway, so the other one that is coming out, Hatching. Have either of you guys seen the trailer for this at all? Have you heard anything about it? Whew. Directed by Hannah Bergholm. It's about a 12-year-old and her mom who find end up raising this egg that they find, and the egg ends up hatching after it grows to an enormous size, and it looks absolutely insane. I think, yeah.
I just looked up the poster and it is truly horrifying.
Yeah. So going from that, we can kind of take a leap into something a little more chill. Let's talk about Netflix has got the series finale season, I think, of Grace and Frankie is dropping on the 29th.
With Dolly Parton.
Yeah. Also, Ozark, the series finale of Ozark drops on the 29th.
Because we haven't all seen the Ozark, do you predict how it might end?
I don't even know if I watched either of the most recent two seasons of it. And I feel like that's on me. So I don't know. I just haven't.
Do you watch Ozark? Are you a fan?
Jared?
I have seen one episode of Ozark. So yeah, it is a mystery to me for the most part.
And yeah, I like a lot about it, but I just cannot get over how dark it is and how the weather is just so oppressive there. And that's not at all what I would assume that area to be.
No.
No. I think of like duck boats and things like that, where it's more upbeat and fun. And this is like, where is this bad riverboat that they've got that they're gaming on? It's like, oh, and I would not stay in their hotel or their motel. It looks just dreadful. So all this stuff is like alien to me, but I'm still fascinated by it. And how they get all kind of cooked up with the drug cartel is bizarre. But and I have not seen the last episode, so this is purely out of the blue. I'm throwing this out there. I think it's going to be like The Godfather, where the next generation is taking over at the end. I just think that those kids have been corrupted so much by their parents being these kind of bad stewards of their lives that they have been absorbing all of this, and they too will be like that in a very dark way.
My knee jerk is that it's just going to be very similar to, you know, Breaking Bad, because that seems like the show that it is most closely related to, I think, tonally and plot wise, of, you know, a character by definition breaking bad, I guess. That whole family just kind of slowly sliding down this very slippery slope into villainy.
I think it's going to end with Jason Bateman surrounded by family and friends, maybe some of the foes as well, and just, you know, looking at the camera and saying, damn, the Ozarks sure are crazy. And then it's gonna cut to black.
Where are the duck boats? Let's go on the duck boats, right?
Yes.
I did get to see a new series that's starting this week. It's called I Love That For You. And it stars Vanessa Bayer, Molly Shannon, and the incredible, incredible Jennifer Lewis. And they work at this home shopping network, not unlike QVC. And Vanessa Bayer is just like, she's dreamed her whole life. She wants to work at this place. And so she gets an audition. She had been a Costco food demonstrator. You know how they hand out samples. And she saw more in her life, and she wanted to take the next step and go to this station where they're selling just every crap you can find. And she gets there and she realizes that they all fit niches. They all have, I am the married mother who can do it all. I am the guy who loves Christ, and I also am a baker. I am the, you know, the successful businesswoman who can have everything. So they all fit niches, but she doesn't see what her niche is. Well, and Jennifer Lewis owns this place. And she comes out and she is just a riot. She's so good. She levels everybody with lines that you will be repeating for weeks afterwards. And she even sold the crap that we couldn't get rid of. So she has a really good way of kind of looking at that world. It doesn't lampoon it. It just kind of reveals it. And it is very fun. Molly Shannon was a role model for Vanessa Bayer. She said she always looked up to her, wanted to be like her. And now the idea that they get to work together, unbelievable. So it's very, 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 very funny. And I think in when we see so many of these dark films, you might look for something like that. But I binged as much as I could right away. That'll be coming on Showtime. And then I got a chance to see second season of Hacks. And oh boy.
You saw all of it or just like the first handful of episodes?
I've seen 6 episodes of it. And I thought, you know, that they kind of got to a point there where they don't know where they're going to go with this. Oh no, it is so set. And I can't talk until we get to May because that's when they're going to start unfolding. But just know that second season of Hacks, I think it almost is even better than the first season because it introduces Deborah Vance, that's the character played by Jean Smart, to all these things that she'd been kind of ignoring for years because she's going out on the road and she's going to try her comedy out where the people really like her, not just in Vegas anymore. And she gets a tour bus and episode 3, I kid you not, if it doesn't win Emmys, it isn't because they didn't try. They have Laurie Metcalf in there who is incredible. And Laurie Metcalf better get the Emmy for that episode 3, best guest actress. She's that good.
You mentioned The Godfather earlier. We were talking
about The Offer is coming soon.
Ozark. I was going to say, yeah, April 28th. On Paramount Plus, and you have you've big upped that a lot, and yes, that is the biopic series, I suppose, where the biographical subject is the Godfather film.
Yeah, and how difficult it was to make it. They did not want that film made, and the mafia moved in and tried to stop it, and then they kind of negotiated, if you will.
And Coppola was a tough cookie, I think, from a production standpoint, very insistent on everything, but he had to be.
His visions, but you know, he wasn't really dealing from a point of strength.
Yeah.
He wasn't who he became.
He didn't have the leverage because I think he had, what was he coming off of then? That was.
Well, he had done The Conversation. That was one of his films that came the same year, but he had done just those kind of smaller things that gave him a name, but he wasn't who he was until The Godfather.
Yeah.
The guy who plays Al Pacino, and I wish I could tell you who it was, looks like Al Pacino, sounds like Al Pacino. So that's kind of fun to play with.
Normally I try to structure these, you know, planning wise to where we will record on Monday or whatever. And then I'll cap the shows that we're going to talk about for Sunday, because we're going to be, you know, talking about, but there's a show that just started as of last night, April 25th on HBO Max, We Own This City, which is the new Baltimore cop show produced by Pelicanos and George Pelicanos and David Simon, which seems like it is the natural heir to The Wire's throne. And I don't know if either of you guys have gotten a chance to see the first episode yet since it came out, but it looks fantastic. Tells the looks like it kind of jumps around timeline wise between pre-Trump and sort of late 2000s, telling the kind of downfall of one police unit based on a true story in Baltimore. So.
Oh, it's got, I hadn't kept good tabs on this, and seeing that Bernthal is in it, I'm all the way in. I don't even need to know the rest of the cast, although I'm sure it's going to be good because all of David Simon's stuff is very well cast.
Yeah, so. It's really great. I mean, I would suggest everybody go in. Anyone who's a fan of The Wire, go in pretty blind, just because you never know which of the Wire, stock actors, the Wire's troupe, are going to show up in sometimes very different roles from what they were originally. But yeah, looks fantastic, feels fantastic. I'm very excited to be following along with that show. Bruce, anything else you got?
Well, another one that has a newspaper base that is very fascinating, it starts on the 29th, is Shining Girls with Elizabeth Moss. And that's it's a thriller. So it's not necessarily where they're just uncovering a crime or, digging into the archives to find a story. There's more here, and I don't want to tell too much more because it might ruin it.
And that's on Apple Plus.
Yeah, and she's great. Elizabeth Moss doesn't get the work that she deserves either. There's another one who could be guided in another direction.
So that kind of wraps up the new stuff coming out. Also, we've got...
Are we going to talk about The Survivor?
Yes, that's... Bruce, why don't you tell us about Survivor before we throw to this interview that you got?
Yeah, well, it's based in truth. It's about a Jewish man who was kept in Auschwitz. And in order to survive, he had to box his way to stay alive. So for the benefit of the guards who were there, they would have boxing matches. And he would do whatever he had to stay alive. And then the story, and you see that from the beginning, you get to see what that kind of black and white era was like. And then he deals with life in the aftermath of that, because he realizes that because he survived, somebody else died. And he has a lot of guilt, and how he deals with that guilt over the course of years. Now, Barry Levinson has shot this in a number of ways. So you're gonna see different techniques, different colors, different kinds of filming techniques. It's very fascinating, but he said he couldn't imagine that Auschwitz would be anything but black and white. And he visited there and was very green. And he said, no, I can't see that because of the way the story is. It's very stark. So I got a chance to talk to Barry Levinson, the director, and Ben Foster, who plays the survivor. And they had worked together 20 years earlier, but they had been looking for something to do and never really found anything. And this turned out to be the piece that they said, yep, this is it. We're going to do this. I can't imagine doing it with anybody else.
Fantastic. The trailer looks amazing for that. So, yeah, so here is Bruce's conversation with the Survivor folks.
Hey, Barry and Ben, what took you so long to get back together? It was like 20 years since you last worked together?
Well, we were trying to find the script.
Yes.
The reality is, we were talking about this earlier. I'm not sure why we didn't. I know there was one... I believe there was one project, but it never came together. But it certainly was, the short answer is it's been way too long.
Way too long.
So what made you think he was right for the role now then?
Well, he seemed the perfect choice, because in other words, he's when I used him in Liberty Heights, I was thinking, he was doing comedy, then he moved into other things and did some great, great work. And then this popped up in my head and I thought, gee, he's got the ability and the range that I think Harry Haft, and I think the commitment to a difficult character to play. I mean, physically, what happens in the camps, learning to box, to be an awkward boxer that is trying to become more of a professional boxer, the emotional range of the whole piece. It was very clear in my mind that Ben Foster could do this role.
Well, Ben, how good did you get at boxing? Were you good at that? Is that something that, just kind of came naturally, or did you not need to really be that good?
Well, Harry wasn't a particularly great boxer, but he certainly was tough as hell. Inconceivable what he endured. I enjoyed learning the sweet science. My father boxes, his father boxed. So it's something that I took pleasure in, but I by no means claim that he was a top athlete. He's a survivor. Sure. And his story got him fights.
Well, when you decided to take the role, then did you say, I have to lose the weight? That's a given for me? Or how did that all come about?
Yeah, when you read the script and talk to Barry, and we're terribly excited that he called me and read it that day. You have to get down to how you're going to do the thing. And I needed to drop the weight for myself. I needed to see how far I could go and still be able to fight. As I intuited, not only it has to look credible. When you see photographs of the concentration camp, when you see the footage dropping 10 pounds or 15 pounds would be, I couldn't face myself. So much of it is perhaps self-deception, what we do, you know, the trade of an actor. So at least for myself is getting to a point where I'm not thinking about it and I'm not self-conscious in any way. I'm just the way that I imagine a musician would feel music.
How difficult though was it to just actually box when you were that thin? Was it?
Yeah, it's always tricky to talk about these things because it's make-believe. You know, we're professional make-believers. We just never gave up the imaginary game in the backyard that we play as kids. It's just on a much higher level. You can imagine it when you're fighting at deficit, you have less resources. You gas out quicker. There are days that are blacked out. I don't remember. And that's just because you're starving the body, you're starving the brain. Again, this is a choice. This was a choice that I made that I intuited would help serve the rest of Harry's story and my own performance, be able to not think about it.
Just being in that ring though, in that setting, how grueling and how mentally draining was that?
It was horrifying, Bruce. It was horrifying. Well, the set that Kreka designed and the way that Barry likes to shoot, which is do your homework and be ready to improvise or play with new colors. Walking onto that set when you have men in SS officers shouting at you and hungry, caged human beings surround, it's very easy to fall into that nightmare.
Yeah, it's grueling to watch. It's grueling to watch. The one thing, Barry, that you did that I found very interesting was how you changed the look at each different time period. When did that strike you, that you would have, you know, this kind of black and white era, you would have the washed out color era? When did all that come into play?
Oh, that came in very early. And to separate it, so because you know you are sliding back and forth in time constantly. So in a sense, you know, for the audience, you know, that it's like they begin to understand one from the other, as opposed to if they all be the same, then you might get, you know, somewhat confused. When we went to Auschwitz and we were walking around and the grass was green. And some things had certain, you know, vivid in terms of color, but the green of the grass and the trees completely threw me. And I realized, and I was thinking black and white when I saw it, it's like, I can't relate to it in color. And I kept thinking and talking to the cinematographer, how in the world could we do it? We can't really do it. So that's how we went, you know, black and white. Schindler's obviously did black and white, and put the entire film stayed in that particular time frame. Here, it wouldn't have made sense to be going through all of this in terms of that. So, and because that the boxing the camps are basically remembrances that Harry has. That's what's haunting him, the past. Sure. It's haunting him. And so the idea that it's in another color, it's easier in terms of, you know, cutting back, cutting, you know, doing that kind of thing. So it came together rather early.
Did you shoot chronologically then? So then everything would be...
We did shoot. Yes, we did. Actually, we shot all the camp stuff. We shut down for a period of time when Ben could start eating, and which was the middle section. And then I think we did all that before we went to the end, which is in Tybee Island, Georgia. So we did do the chronological in terms of time periods.
And Ben, how difficult was it having those prosthetic things on your face in the older years? Was that a difficult thing to act around or to deal with?
What prosthetics?
Oh, come on now, you know better.
I enjoyed my pasta immensely. the designer is one of our great makeup artists, and I've worked with him for years, Jamie Kelman. I don't really think about it. Yeah. It just helps me feel. It's like, it's like when you're getting ready for bed, it's like putting on your pajamas. It's, if you put on a tuxedo, that would be very confusing. Yeah. I wasn't confused. It just felt like I was slipping into him.
Did you have a film of him? Did you have any kind of footage that you could look at to kind of get a sense of him?
Yes, the Shoah Foundation was provided a lot of insight and their library of testimonies. So there is a Harry's testimony, but upon watching it, I didn't want to do an impression of Harry. I was looking more for an essence and finding the man in myself. We did a lot of work with a Yiddish expert to make sure that the dialect was specific to the area at Bełchatów, Poland. We got down to the neighborhood so that Yiddish would feel lived in. So we took his accent, but it wasn't so much, just want to avoid impersonating anything.
Watching those films, and what impressed you most about him? What kind of resonated when you said, that I've got to capture that?
Oh gosh. When one thinks about survivors of the camps, we think about the wounded and the weak and the grief. What I was so shook by was the brute confidence that comes with surviving.
Yeah.
And understanding that his story, or the story that we're telling, is also deeply romantic. Harry's a romantic. It might not be the first word that we think about him, but it's all for his love back home. And that hope for love, to see love again, is the thing that got him through. That was shocking to find.
It resonates, I think. I really do.
Nice.
Thank you both for doing this too. And tell Billy Magnuson he did a great job. That's a difficult role. And to work with you, Ben, under those circumstances, wow. So thank you both. I'm waiting to see that this is received as well as it should be, because we need films like this now. We really do.
Appreciate it, Bruce. Thank you.
Jared?
Yes.
We can let you take us out.
Absolutely.
Are you sure it's the real Jared and it's not the Velisca shadow of his former self?
We'll see in the coming weeks if my takes all of a sudden start changing on things, like movies I once liked I now denounce, then maybe something has gone awry. But with as much good stuff as there is out right now with The Northman and Everything Everywhere All at Once is still out in theaters, and I got to see that too, and it was just a wonderful movie and one of my favorites I've seen so far this year. And The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, go and see something good at the theaters, or stream something good at home. You've got a lot of great options right now, so there's no excuse to just keep rewatching the same old stuff.
See something good. Thank you two gentlemen for being on the show, and thanks to everyone who listened. We will be back next week. Who you got an interview for next week lined up, Bruce? Next week
we're going to look at it, and we're talking with an animator from Encanto. She's featured in a new series on Disney Plus called Sketchbook, and she talks about, you know, what it's like, her dream job. She wanted to be at Disney. Here's what she did.
Does she talk about Bruno?
Oh, I cannot tell you about that. Can I tell you? Because I asked that whole, it's a point. You want to listen to that just to be able to get that.
We will let everybody who's interested in that wait with bated breath 1 week. And if they want to hear it, they should totally subscribe to the show wherever they get podcasts, streamed and screened. You can find us on all the places. We'll have links in the show notes to movies that we talked about. And we'll be back next week with all that good stuff. Thank you guys so much. See something good.
Amen.
At a time when the world was falling apart, we turned to the movies.